away what they were. So what we're going to do is just finish this little bit of mathematics, and the pad will actually be able to see mathematically really where they are. So I'll be fine. I don't need to set the web now. Okay. Great. So where were we? I got through all of that. What was that? Okay.
Okay, so
before lunch we're doing these problems, and we came up with we kind of had this interferometer, this network of mirrors, and half silver mirrors, and we added this little piece of glass or a phase shifter that kind of added this extra phase, and that was like making shallower water in a ripple tank, which increases the phase or just makes, in a sense, really think of the photon like a wave, like a really more compact wave. So it makes kind of the sine wave oscillate faster and gets through the cycles quicker. So it's an extra phase value onto it. And the way we represent that mathematically was by putting this extra e to the I phi. And you may think that's kind of weird, but remember, there's kind of hidden in the e to the I phi, there are sines and cosines. Because remember, Euler's formula. So we really do have some trig functions in there. So hopefully that makes that a little bit clearer. And so that's the transformation. So as we kind of stream through this network here, what we have is the photon going through there, goes to another state after it's gone through the beam splitter, which is the half-silver mirror, which is this state. And then it goes, this one here, goes through the piece of glass, builds up this extra factor here, it's called a phase factor, which is really just shows you the extra, I guess, part of the cycle that we go through, and which physically is like rotating it round in sort of a real imaginary graph. So the state goes here, and then we go through the second half-silver mirror, and we know what happens to that. We know how we transform or update the state of the photon or the photon. We just pre-multiply it by this matrix here. So it's just simple matrix multiplication, which we saw before. And you can verify yourself that you get that answer there. So what we have is that's the final state. And when phi is equal to pi, what we want to figure out is what that is. So we take the final state, which is that there, and we substitute pi in there. So
it was mine.
Lots of people took photos of that, didn't they? No. Someone?
No.
Oh, well.
Do you want a time machine?
Okay. Got it. Okay, so one. Okay, so we just substitute pi in here.
Isn't that overkill?
Well, you never be too careful.
Less careful.
Okay. Right. Okay, so this is what we have. So, okay, we need to figure out what pi is. So we use Euler's formula. We know what that is. And the cosine of pi, does anyone know what that is?
-1.
Yeah. Cosine of pi -1, and then 0, right. Okay. -1 there. So -1, 0. Oh, sorry. Okay, right. And then minus one. Okay, so okay, so that's the answer there. And so what's the probability of finding the photon in path one? 100%. Yep. And path two?
Zero.
Okay. So notice it was the other way around before. So before it was the other way, the 100% and 0% were swapped around. Remember when it went way back to before? It was 100% of finding it in, I think it was path two, and then 0% of path one. So 100% at detector B and 0% at detector A. Now it's actually just by changing the phase, we changed the way the two things interfere, we've actually swapped it around. So, and essentially what happens is, just by adding this phase, if we have an so phi equals zero, we have 0%, 100%. Phi equals pi on two, 100%, 0%. So if we add pi. So if we had pi or phi somewhere in between zero and pi, what do you think would happen to the percentages? Exactly. Somewhere in between the two. So just by varying this phase factor, we can actually vary, continually vary the percentages somewhere in between 0, 100% and 0%. And so what we'll see in the second problem, we have, do you want me to go through the second problem?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go through the second problem. Do I have the answer? Yep, I do. Okay. Can I rub this out? Yeah, that's right. Okay. So I'm going to need some help with this from you. So we have this. So what should I do with phi? What should I do with pi and four? Where should I put that? Put it here. Okay, right. So put it. Yep. Thank you, Dennis. So this is a bit too. So substitute pi and four in there. Yep. And then, does anyone have any suggestions for the next step as to what we should do? So wait, who is?
Extend the post parallel or plus sine.
Well, okay.
Build in the plane and then make some geometric or some geometric for the theorem, and yeah, it's easy.
Draw it. Okay. Okay, so we have two ways of doing it, which is fantastic. And you often get that, and you get in theoretical physics, you can get one problem and two ways. So is it okay if we do the other way now, Dennis? Is that alright? If we do the other way first. Okay, but that was, yeah, you can definitely do that. So you were saying draw it geometrically like this, I think you were saying. So 1 minus or something like that.
Less
Right, so it'll be, so it'll be something like that there, and then, yep. Okay, so that's the valid way of doing it, but we'll do it. So you have your name tag. It's, what was your name?
Alyssa.
Alyssa, right, okay. Great. Okay, so using Euler's formula, 1 minus cosine pi over 4. Okay, so cosine pi over 4 equals 1 over root 2, okay, 1 minus 1 over root 2, and then the minus sign minus over root 2, and then so we...
You mean I in there.
You mean that?
Yeah.
Yep, okay, thank you. So here we have, and, sorry?
9 minus 1 over 2 plus I over
2. Oh, right, okay, yep, thank you. So Dennis just, so we've got I multiplied by I, which equals minus 1, and then 1 over root 2, which gives us that, which is what Dennis just said, and then I 1 plus 1 over 2. Okay, so that's what we've got just by... doing that. Okay, so what we need to do to calculate the probabilities are the first one... okay, let's see how we do. To the first one, let's just find the magnitude of this. So move this up here. Okay. So I want to find the magnitude of. One over root two, so the magnitude of that, so that's at the form U equals A plus IB. So find the magnitude of that. That's just equal to okay. So and then we square that to find the probability. So I guess to square it, we can get rid of, we're going to take the square of it anyway, so what we want to find is u squared, magnitude squared, so square root and the square. Actually, we'll just take it step by step. So we want to find our, this value here, so square that, so... plus 1 over root 2 squared, and then take the square root of all of that. So this will give us 1 minus 2 divided by root 2 plus 1/2 plus 1/2 again, the square root. So that gives us 2 minus 2 divided by the square root of 2. Did I forget a factor of half somewhere?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, okay. So we've got to have half out the front, so got to put a half there. Let's just add a half there, so my apologies for that. Okay, so we've got to add a half. I think so, yeah, that's right. Add a half there, so everyone's happy now. Okay, so so if we square okay, so square that, you get divided by 4, and then what we had before, 1 minus 2 divided by root 2. Plus 1/2 plus, so that's square root of 8, so that's 1/8 there. Okay, so we have, let me see, that's 1/8 plus 1/8, so which gives us 1/4 plus 1/4, so that will give us 1/2. And then we have, so that's minus, so that's 1/2 root 2. Okay, so that's equal to the magnitude of that component, the 2-1 component in the, or the 1-1 component of the matrix. So what we know, the probability is the square of the magnitude, so we just need to take the square of that, which is good because we have a square root there. So if we take the square of that, the square of the square root, the squares root just cancels out. Therefore, we kind of go up here. So really we go in this logical order. So, therefore, the probability is 1/2 minus 1/2 times root 2. Does anyone, I mean, you can figure out what that is in the calculator. 15%? Okay. Right. Yep.
How do you
Root
that and get the same thing?
How do I? Which bit? Sorry, I couldn't hear the Elise.
How do you root that and still
find out
the same thing?
Oh, okay, yeah. So we took the square root, so actually it's a little bit confused, but okay, so basically, we squared it afterwards, so. So does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, so I guess I wasn't clear, but that is equal to the magnitude of A, but the probability is the square of the magnitude, so we need to square that again. So obviously, if we just. Okay, we get that. And you can go through and calculate the other probability, but if the probabilities add up to 1, and that's one probability, what's the other one? The other one's 1 minus 8, exactly. So it actually turns out to be 1 plus 1/2 root 2. So they're the two probabilities in that case. And so effectively it turned to be 15%, and then 85%. So you can see we've changed the angle a bit, we've added this phase factor, and we've changed, we're somewhere in between 100% and 0%. And it might look like much, but we're actually adding another dimension to the problem, and when we go and have a look at quantum mechanics in general, we'll find out this will be a very, very significant thing. So we've got about, so I won't do problem 3. Actually, can I just get to show up in hands, how many people did problem 3? Okay, that's okay. So see Dennis if you want the solution.
Wait.
Gonna have your write it down.
I have the same solution.
Okay. Wait. How are you? Okay, could I have everyone's attention for a second, Dennis is yep.
I am to explain a solution or to
write it down. So yeah, here's a razor. Yeah, sure. Okay, yep. Okay, sure. Yep. right, okay.
These are magnitudes that are precisely these are written in another way.
And how do you get there?
We can ask that.
In general case, with phi.
Sorry?
With general phi.
General
phi.
No.
You did that for the other case. So the question was meant to be represent that in polar coordinates. Oh, I guess really.
It's really hard.
Oh, actually, yeah. So I guess I was saying just. What was the question? Okay. What was I trying to ask? Oh, yeah, I guess I was just asking just... So that's kind of... That's in a bit of both a combination of rectangular and polar coordinates. So just represent, I guess, basically like you had. So you put in polar coordinates. Because look at each of the elements in that matrix, that's not of the form the magnitude of u e to the I theta. E to the I phi. That's, I mean, if you look at each of the forms, it's not there, but what Dennis has done for that case is. So that's what I was looking for. And then you could do it in the general case, where phi is just a general number. So that's right for that particular case. So thank you very much. Okay. So back to some more stuff. Okay, so that was... Okay, so the t-shirt's done. Right. So maybe if anyone has any questions about them, I'm happy to take that during the break. That was kind of an advanced question, so I won't take any more questions about that now. But all what the question was, so if this is kind of troubling, don't worry about it. That was just an extra question. See if anyone could do it. But that was really represent each of the two elements there in the form magnitude of u e to the I phi, which Dennis did for the particular case of phi equals pi over 4. And you can do it even further going to the more general case. So, okay. So, moving on. So I understand you have a lot of free time in the evenings. So this is just an extra question if anyone would like another problem. I'll just put that down there. I won't go through it. We won't do it now, but if anyone would like to, feel free to. The only thing I should point out that we haven't done, we looked at the transpose of a matrix, but we didn't look at the complex conjugate of a matrix. And so we have this idea with complex numbers. It was in the math primer. It's really useful. We won't go through. The only thing you need to know for that is... that for various reasons, we have a complex number. Remember, u equals a plus bi. It's useful to define the conjugate of that, which just has a minus b instead of a plus b. So it just turns out that that's really, really, really useful. And so I think this is in the math primer as well, but the square root of that is equal to the magnitude of the complex number. So that's one use of that. Don't worry too much about that, just what's in that box there. So that's one complex number. So if we have 4 plus 3i u star equals 4 exactly minus 3i. And just as if we can do that for one element, If we have a matrix, we can take the complex conjugate of a matrix and we just... Sorry? That's all we're doing. We can take the complex conjugate of every element in the matrix. So we can do that. And that's all you need to know to figure out that question, everything else we've done. But that's just another the spare time you'll have. Okay, so what I'd like to do is I'd like to give you a challenge now. And if
finally.
Well, actually, do you have...
No.
Okay. Maybe if you can hand out these. So, okay. So, what we've actually been doing, it might not have seemed like it, but has anyone seen the movie Karate Kid? Or is that still... Okay. So, Mr. Miyagi and Daniel, this is a young kid. If you haven't, this was from way back when I was young. But there was a movie called Karate Kid about a young guy that wanted to learn karate. And so went to an old Japanese man that lived in the same apartment block as him. And what happened then, he just started getting him to clean the apartment and do some sanding and wax on and wax off. And what he seemed like he was just doing is actually just simple menial tasks. And he didn't think he was actually learning any karate. But meanwhile, he actually was, because this was one of the block moves, and that was another block move, and stuff like that. So kind of that's what I've been doing. So you may think we've just been learning about matrices and basic quantum mechanics. But with everything I've given you now, you can actually solve the problem that's in front of you. So we'll go on to this now. So what I'll do is I'll just state the problem, and then maybe tomorrow on Friday, seeing how you go, we'll give the answer out. So, so it turns out with this interferometer, the network of mirrors and stuff. So there's actually a museum. It's somewhere here in Ontario, and they have in Toronto, and they have the world's most expensive diamond. It's like billions of dollars. It's called the Toronto Diamond. And I'm sure Mark, you'll back me up. It's real. And it's kept safe by a very unusual security system in a large room in the Toronto Museum. And the museum's owners are very, very protective of it. So it's a really expensive diamond. And so they would actually rather see it destroyed than being stolen, because it has historical value and sentimental value, and it's just, they would just hate to see it in the wrong hands. So what I would like you to challenge you to do is to figure out a way of using quantum physics to bypass the security system and actually steal the diamond. Or think of a way to do that.
We don't have to use quantum physics.
Sorry? You have to use quantum physics. You have, yes?
So you're encouraging us to use what you've taught us to for criminal activity?
So this is an institute for theoretical physics. So I encourage you to figure out a theoretical way of doing it, not to actually do it. Not a practical way. So I'm not. Just like to go on record that I'm not encouraging you to be international diamond thieves. And where parents would hate us if they came back and you said, what did you learn? We learned how to steal diamonds. Okay, so this is your challenge. And this is a pretty tough problem. This was something only figured out in quantum physics in the 1990s. So it's a tough challenge I'm giving you. But if you get it, there's an extra challenge as well I can give you. So you don't know exactly where the diamond is. So I'm going to tell you the rules. These are rules. You don't know exactly where it is. So you need to find it. Just somehow locate where the diamond is. And you can only use light to do that, only photon. But the point is, the diamond is so... what I should have said is, so there's actually a line missing there. So what I should have said is, the diamond is actually so sensitive that if it actually one photon is in a room that's completely dark. So there's no photons in there, and if just one photon hits the, one visible photon hits the diamond, it's basically rigged up to this security system that it will actually just explode the diamond and shatter it and have to be destroyed. So that's what I mean by, so if you basically go in there, completely dark room with your little sort of thief costume and stuff, and you shine a flashlight on it, it will just explode it. So it won't work. Right, and you can only use visible photons. So you can only use visible photons. So it's a very unusual system, but it's true, it's real. I'm not making this up. And so what you need to find, you can't simply look for it, because to look at it, by the time you've seen it, you actually had to reflect photons off it. And so by the time you've already seen it directly, it's actually blown up, it's destroyed. And so the question is, can you find out where it is by using quantum physics and using the stuff that we've done so far? And even probabilistically. And so obviously to steal it, you need to know where it is. So you need to find out where it is. And so is there any way, even not with 100% certainty, but with maybe of knowing where it is, even with a probability, such as 25%, and that 25% is a significant value. And so that's your challenge. So just to kind of make sure everything makes sense, we have, okay, so if we had, say that's a half silver mirror there, and so if we had one of these photons going through, what we would obviously would measure at 50% the time to be transmitted, and 50% to be reflected. So in this case, 50% of the time, if we shot 100 photons in here, we had $100 billion diamonds, which is probably not really practical, but we would find 50% of the time this detector B going off and saying, yes, there was a photon there. And the other 50% of the time, we would find with those 50 diamonds, they would be destroyed because the photon would be reflected up and we would measure it to destroy the diamond. So this is what happens. So even though in some sense we say the photon takes both paths, we only measure it. We've only got one photon, so we only measure it one path. If we measure it one path and it gets reflected up, then it destroys the diamond. So that's... Sorry, no. So this is hypothetical. So this is just kind of setting up the problem. Yes?
Can you put mirrors in? Yes,
you can. You're allowed to put mirrors in. So, yeah, and you have to use the quantum physics stuff we've done.
Do you know where the dark room where the diamond is?
No, you don't. You don't. So essentially, this is a problem of you're trying to locate the diamond, find out where it is without having any, even a single photon. So trying to use light to find out where it is. Well, so it... Can I just, yeah. So I didn't hear the question you had. So what was your statement then? Okay, so is the question up the front here? Wait.
No.
Okay, Stephen. So
the diamond is just hanging flying in the mid-air somewhere.
No, it's resting. It's resting on a table, or it's resting on a pedestal, or something like that.
Maybe you can disconnect.
Sorry.
Maybe you can disconnect.
No, it's locked down. So yep, wait, if I could have a question?
There's nothing else we can do except for the photon detector or thing and darkness.
So there's nothing else you need.
There's nothing else protecting it, like other than the darkness and the fact that it will explode and the photons hit it.
No, the detector's the diamond explodes.
No, there's not.
Okay.
There's not. But wait. Could you raise your hand? You've got a question.
How do you know where to put the mirrors if you don't know where the diamond is? You may ask.
Right. You know the diamond's in one of a number of places, so you can do sort of a trial and error process. You just through a trial and error process.
So let's just say we know what room the diamond is in.
You know what room it is in, yeah.
Okay, yep. So it's six boxes.
Wait, we've got a question there, yep.
No.
Yes.
We know the specific properties of the diamond, like how much it shapes the label and anything.
It's a regular diamond, so you can look it up in a chemistry textbook. So it's just a regular diamond, carbon.
So that doesn't.
No. And what I'll say is there is a way of doing it, actually just using.
Why don't you kill around for it?
Exactly.
Well, but you, I mean, that would be, you don't know where it is, so you'd be fumbling around forever, it's a big room, so it would take a long time. Sorry. Wait, one more, yep? Well, you can only use, okay, visit, night vision goggles, with night vision goggles, they pick up infrared radiation coming off, and that's not visible. And the rules of the game are you can only use visible photons.
So,
okay, you're getting into semantics. Okay, so what I'll tell you is there is a way of doing it, not 100% certain, but there is a probabilistic way, with a certain probability of finding out where the diamond is, just using this setup. So just using this interferometer here, and you actually don't even need to use the phase shifter. So just using that. And so there is a way that if the diamond is in one of these arms, you can find out what it is, where it is without actually spotting it. So that's all I'm going to say, and that's your challenge for tonight. Does anyone have any questions? Yes, one more question, and then yep.
What about if the diamond gets hit by two photons, and like photons can have the characteristics of the wavelength or of a photon,
right?
So they can cancel each other out.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't even, they actually would not hit the diamond, right? Is that possible?
Right,
yeah.
No, so in this case, you're only allowed to use one photon.
We're only
giving you one photon as a diamond thing.
Okay.
Photons are expensive. Okay. Wait. Yep. The photons would not. So the question was, do we know how much of a phase shift the diamond would make in the photon? So the diamond would actually absorb the photon and it would not actually get through. So in a sense, it's like not a non-transparent object. That's really what it is.
So it's not a transparent object.
It's not a transparent object with the security system around. Yeah, one more question. Wait, sorry, I can't hear the question.
It's really possible without that phase shift.
Yes. It's possible. Okay, that's all I'm going to say. So that's your challenge tonight. Okay, so I need everyone's attention. Okay, so that's your challenge, and tomorrow I'll give you the solution. If you get that, there's actually a 100% way, foolproof way of doing it. But you do, that's a little bit more complicated. You need to know a few more things about that. But that's actually an extra problem. So we'll go through the solution tomorrow. So that is your challenge, to be a diamond thief. Okay. Well, theoretically, diamond thief. So what I'm going to do now. Okay. So I said we had a special guest presenter, a new lecturer coming in, going to give a talk for the next hour or so. And so I'll just introduce him now. So I have Stefan Alexander. And just to introduce him, Stefan I was born in the Caribbean, in Trinidad and Tobago. And when he was 8 years old, he moved to New York City with his family. And then he's currently, so the area would be quantum gravity and particle physics. He's actually not at Perimeter Institute, but I believe Penn State University, Pennsylvania State University at the moment. And we're lucky enough to have him visiting, doing some work with some of our researchers, such as Lee Smolin, who's giving a presentation to you tomorrow. And I guess I won't really sort of explain what he's going to talk about. That would probably be best left to him to explain what he'll talk about. But we're very, very lucky to have him here. It's a very interesting story about how he got into physics. And in his spare time, I believe, he's very much into jazz and actually playing jazz music and listening to jazz music. So I don't know if he'll do some of that during the presentation. But without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Stefan Alexander.
I'm 35, I've been involved here. One thing you learn is that, well, you're all underage, but I don't know what the rules are in Canada, but you're not supposed to be mixed beer and wine. Wine is good to you, so it's a, you know, it's a natural antioxidant. That made it even a better excuse for me to drink more. I've been involved with PI since day one, since it was, you know, the executive direction. I was crashing it. Well, I shouldn't get too much into, like, you know, but basically, my 5 years ago, I was a postdoc at Imperial College in London, and Lee Smolin was there, Professor Smolin here at the Perimeter Institute. When the Perimeter was being formed, I happened to be crashing it on Lee's couch, because I didn't have a place to live anymore. I just moved into London. And it just amazes me that, you know, that PI is what it is now, and it's really leading the world, this institute, and what it represents, and the spirit of this place. And, you know, the fact that you're all here reflects the germ, you know, that germ, what this place is about. It's really leading the world. It's really pointing to, like, what the future could be like for science and research and humanity in general. And I'm just really proud, and proud is not the word. I'm just beaming with, like, you know, joy and glee. And what's the other word? Anyway, so I just wanted to, it's always good to, like, big things up, you know, so I'm here, and so now I'm a professor at Penn State University. Penn State is the only other place in North America that does both string theory, which is something I'm involved with, and what we call a canonical approach to quantum gravity. So normally, you know, in North America, right now, high energy physics, I mean, particle physics or quantum gravity, is dominated by one particular philosophy, which is string theory, or hypothesis, which is a string hypothesis. And Perimeter is one of the few places in the world that does both. So I think that says a lot about the spirit of the place. But I'm saying this because I wanted to say a little thing about research, a little thing about kind of science, but you're going to have enough of that. I've seen, like, all these equations on the board, stuff that you know, it looks pretty hardcore for high school students. This guy's really working. I don't want to add more brain stuff to you. So one of the things I want to talk about is the notion of creativity. You know, the notion of being smart, being intelligent. I recall when I was, so there was a time where I decided I didn't want to be a physicist. I went to graduate school, and I realized that, man, maybe I'm not smart enough here. You know, everyone was just super smart. They were like acing exams, and I'm like struggling to, you know, do the problem sets. Wasn't feeling that smart. And of course, that reacts into how you feel about your confidence level. At least my confidence level went all the way down. So maybe I should just slide out of physics, you know, on there. So I decided to just like leave, slowly get out of it. So, but before I did that, I went to one of my professors, and he said to me, you should do something else. Try a different kind of science. How about like biology? I can get some biology. He said, yeah, there's biophysics. Well, that sounds kind of cool. He said, yeah, like lipid. In fact, you know, my PhD advisor, Walter Gilbert, I was his only physics student, and he and Watson started working on something, and then he started doing biology, and then he won a Nobel Prize for recombinant DNA technology. I was like, what's this physics guy actually left? And he said, yeah, you should go meet him. So I went to Harvard University, and I went to this guy, had this huge office. He had his own gym in his office. And I can tell he was on some kind of genetic therapy because he's older than this my physics professor. And he looks like my age. So I was like, there's something weird about this guy. You know, he looks too young to be 80 or something. So anyway, this guy, we're talking, and I said, you know, I don't know, I'm thinking of leaving physics. He said, you have to do what you love. He said, don't make a decision based on, you know, how smart you think you are. And you can't let anyone define that. You have to follow your own agenda. I was like, well, this is kind of weird. You know, I'm talking to a Nobel Prize winning scientist. Very few scientists in their lifetime will ever experience what it means to make a fundamental discovery to win the Nobel Prize. And I have this guy here telling me that I should follow my passion. And that he was also telling me, you shouldn't let, you know, the way you're thinking about, you know, how smart you are or how creative you are has very little to do with actuality. And, you know, of course, I carried a lot of weight coming from this guy. Had it come from my mother, who's been telling me that, they'd mean anything. But I decided to try biology anyway. So I went to the lab, and the minute I realized, there's a chemical, if I sniff it, I can die on the spot. I said, okay, no sodium azide for me. So I went back to Brown, and I finished up. But then I realized that I still had doubts. You know, I went and did a postdoc, and again, people were like much smarter than me, much more creative, writing papers, you know, getting invited to big talks, hanging out with the, you know, with supermodels. No, that doesn't count. I can't do this. I still can't do this. So I got really depressed. I was a postdoc, and of course I was like, you know, the only like North American person at the time in this European school, and they're very technical of it. They're all about calculation. They breathe and eat calculations. And I'm like, you know, Mr. Like, you know, well, it just flows this way. What sign ever? So I got depressed. I became a drunk, basically. I hung out in like cafes in Paris. And I became friends with this bum. Actually, there was this guy. He was an interesting person. He was this person that spoke like 11 languages. And he decided that he gave up on society. And so he just hung out all the time at this pub that I used to go to, rather than going into the hangout. By the way, as I'm saying this to you guys, don't try this at home. I don't want you guys to go up to some cafe and be like, well, you know, Stefan said that, like, you know, this is how we tap into his creativity. The point is that I was thinking deeply about was thinking very deeply, and I was always about trying to do weird science or follow my passion. But my point in saying all this is that those two, doubt, okay, doubt, passion, and the results that come out of it are never things that are resolved. Those things are very much interrelated. So I'm, you know, I'm reflecting on this and realizing, and have realized, and so that when you have doubt, it's normal. It's normal to have doubt, and it's normal to sort of like to hold on to that doubt and let that be a source of your inspiration. So even though I had my doubt, I didn't just go to the cafe and was just sulked in my depression and did nothing about it. I went in this cafe, I became friends with this really intelligent man, even though he was a vagrant and had some very strange ideas. But he had, you know, he was also really smart. He actually knew some stuff about physics. So I would tell him crazy ideas, and he would tell me crazy ideas, and, you know, I would go up and I would calculate in this cafe and do things. And I went back to Imperial, and my boss said, "So, what do you have to say for the 3 months that we spent £5,000 on you?" But I was hanging out, getting drunk with a bum. So I said, well, you know, actually I did this thing about colliding universes and whatever. Yeah, that's what I did. He said, well, actually, you should write that up right away because the Hawking group is writing a paper right now about this. And you should, you know, you're going to get scooped. I was like, okay. So I went and I wrote something up, and I gave it to this guy. He looked at me and says, well, okay, this is good. You need to write something a little bit more. Probably we got a week left. I was like, okay, I wrote the paper up. And then I put the paper up, and then I got an email from, like, you know, the group at Cambridge and the group at Princeton, and they were like, hey, you just scooped us, so whatever. Like, and it turned out to be like this big paper in the field, over 100 citations and all this stuff. I know, it's amazing. The point in saying this is, okay, there's no way I could have predicted that. And I had my doubts about myself. I still have my doubts about myself. We are in a world and in a society where we are always compared either directly or indirectly with one another. So when I went into that cafe and I saw this old man that smelled a little bit kind of bad or whatever, you know, if I was working within the framework of society, I would be comparing myself to him. I would be saying like, oh, I'm better than this guy. I'm a PhD, da-da-da, in Imperial College, and, you know, I shouldn't be talking to him. I would be comparing myself. I would be judging him. But, you see, because I was down on myself, I learned a lesson about that. I learned that it's important to, when the moment is right, to embrace and be open-minded in our interactions. And in a sense, I had a collaboration going on with this guy. And I benefited from it. So I think that the lesson that I learned there was a lesson, which is that to embrace other people. And I think that, you know, I look at this audience, and I actually was, 3 years ago, was involved with this program. I was one of the mentors, a group mentors. I did it for 2 years. And I followed a few students as years went on. And it was a very interesting. I remember some of the students, like you guys, the top students. And some of you went all the way, went hardcore in science, you know, engineering, physics. Some went into medicine. Some went into the arts. Okay? Some might go into the arts and become a scientist later on. I mean, right now, I might actually end up becoming a professional musician. It doesn't matter. What matters is whatever you do, you do it the very best that you are able to do it, and you follow your own agenda. And what also matters is how you interrelate with one another. Because that is much larger than you as an individual. So I'm going to end with that and leave it open for questions or comments. And it's absolutely OK to disagree with me. And I said, don't practice this at home. Don't go out to a cafe. Stay here. Interact, learn from one another, and question everything, and have fun, most of all. Thank you.
I'm sure we'll have any questions from...
Yes.
After you had your paper published and citation, did you go back and talk to the guy and tell him what happened?
So I was back in London at the time. So he was in Paris, so I never made it back to Paris after that. But had I been back in Paris, of course I'd seek him out. Yeah. But a lot of ways I'm thanking him now by choosing to tell this story. So this is maybe one of these days you might run into a Paris. Yeah, someone told me about you.
Actually, could I just add, you said your paper had 100 citations, but you just say, probably for an average paper in physics, I would say the number of citations would be something like 3 or 4. I mean, I think 2 was the most I've ever got. And so maybe 1 paper in 1,000 or 1 paper in 10,000 or only 1 paper in 20,000, you get 100 citations. Or more, so it is, you just kind of slid that in, it's a big thing, it's not your average paper.
So the idea is really simple, it's not clear that it's true, but it never hurts to theorize, you guys want to hear what the idea was?
Yeah!
So I have time, that's why I kind of didn't want to talk about. But so one of the problems in I kind of work at the interface of cosmology, the early universe cosmology, and fundamental theory, string theory, quantum gravity. It's very hard to make observational contact with these things, these theories out there. And the question is, how do we make observational contact? Well, we do this because there's something called a cosmic microwave background radiation. Okay, what is this thing? So, you guys have probably heard about this.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know what it is. No one else. Okay, the best way to think about it is there's a balloon. You fill a balloon with hot gas. The gas is isotropic, spatially isotropic, and then the balloon expands. So what happens to the temperature as it's moving?
It drops.
Good. So now, what I want us to do now is think that this, the universe, is expanding. And in earlier time, it was about the size of a nickel. Hard to imagine, but that's the case. So, and the temperature was very hot, roughly like 20,000 degrees Kelvin. Okay, it's very hot. And it was just filled with pure radiation. And then it cooled and matter and structure formed. And so, the idea now is that here we are sitting at some point in our time, we look back. Light comes in, basically, to us. But this light actually gets stretched out as the universe expands. And so the temperature we measure is what, roughly 3 degrees Kelvin. That's roughly -270 degrees Celsius. Very faint temperature. Basically, it's the afterglow that tells us, gives us information right after the Big Bang. Okay, and that's cosmic microwave background radiation. The thing that's interesting is that the temperature isn't really 3 degrees. It's 3 degrees plus or minus fluctuations with 5 decimal points And these tiny fluctuations are the quantum ripples or the fossil imprint of some period before, okay, when this temperature established itself. This fluctuation is called a quantum fluctuation. All right. And it turns out, what's cool about that is there's this thing called cosmic inflation, which says that the reason why the universe got to be in this state in the past, all right, to give you this very hot phase, is coming from the fact that before that, you had this, the universe was this tiny seed, okay? In fact, it was a whole quantum form of this. I'm giving you the whole general picture. But this is the speculation. That the universe is this quantum form, and there was a quantum fluctuation from which the whole universe was born, and there was a superluminal expansion. And the quantum fluctuations that occurred there, okay, left an imprint, okay, of this amount. As the universe continued to expand, these tiny quantum fluctuations grew into galaxies and stars. The thing that is amazing is that if you actually do the calculation of inflation, it predicts the spectrum that is observed. It predicts this kind of this picture. And that's a whole song and dance that, you know, you can do a PhD on that. But what's interesting, you can ask yourself the question, where does inflation come from? How did inflation get started? Okay. And some people believe you need to turn to a theory of quantum gravity. So you do quantum gravity. Because at this time, the universe is very, very small, roughly the Planck length, 10 to the minus 34 centimeters. And at that scale, even geometry itself, okay, becomes quantum mechanical. And so there are two approaches, string theory and quantum gravity. So the idea is, can you obtain cosmic inflation from string theory, for example? And so my idea was very simple. So this guy's tell me, he thought that he was some kind of Buddhist master or something, right? And he told me, oh, what is the sound of one hand clap? That's what he's telling me all the time. Right. I still can't do that. So I was like, oh, that's interesting, because in string theory you have objects called Lebrings. And these are high dimensional objects that strings can end on. So strings could collectively end on, so you have strings, that's all over the damn place. So, you know, but if you solve the equations of string theory, what you find is that these strings could collectively, you know, end on some residual surface. So you can either focus on all these strings or just describe the surface that they, you know, end on. And so if I had a two-dimensional surface that strings end on, that's called a two-brain. But then there are higher dimensional objects and those are called D-brains. D stands for the dimension. Of course, D can go up to 9. Okay. So at the time, my colleague Lisa Randall at Harvard wrote a paper called an alternative to compactification. And it was a big deal. And the question was like, oh, how do you, and that basically said that actually our three-dimensional space-time is a defect. Okay, it's a space-time defect. It's a brain by which matter gets stuck onto. And then she was able to explain why it was that gravity was weaker than all the other forces. It's called the hierarchy problem, just from this construction. And so I naturally asked myself the question, oh, if we live on this one thing, if I believe Lisa, and I believe her equations, and I also believe inflation, how do these two things come together? And my answer to the sound of one hand clapping is that make two hands one. If I have brains that annihilate. And I just followed my nose and I solved the equation to string theory. I was able to identify the origin of the field that drove inflation, the inflaton field. So inflaton is driven by some field, like similar to the electromagnetic field, except that this field has spin zero, has zero spin. The electromagnetic field has spin one. So the point is, as these brains came together and annihilated, okay, that, in a sense, would mimic something like a big bang. And these things are highly energetic. And I don't want to tell you how energetic. It's roughly like 10 to the 15 gigaelectron volts. So the point is, the reason I'm telling you about it is I think it's a crazy idea. And for some reason, people in the community started liking it. And I actually was at a bar, like doing this stuff, not just playing around with ideas. So that's the idea. And I think the reason why I told you about that is someone asked me. But someone said something and I said that's part of the idea.
I just asked if they're going back and forth.
Oh, yeah. So now I told you the idea, you can go tell the guy.
Are there any more questions?
So is that what a brain is, a place where strings end? I read that and I was like.
Right, so let me give you a better example of it. When you solve an equation, right, like a differential equation, like as a function, and it depends on time, a function, EF, ET, Newton's law, right? F is equal to MA, right? This is nothing more than, you guys want to give me a good
example?
Yes.
Okay. Very expert. I'm sorry, I wasn't learning this stuff, I was basically stupid, right? So if I solve this thing, like I solve this for equation, this thing goes as t squared, x, if there's no external force, right? And that's the way you think, where you get vt squared from, right? Of course, there's a driving force, you can get. But actually, this thing had a driving force, for example, like it's a spring, right? Then I could have minus kx. Right. So then I have to solve this thing, and it's an oscillator. It becomes an oscillator, right? However, if I solve this oscillator and I say, well, what's the velocity of the oscillator? I take a derivative, right? And I solve for that, and it's also an oscillator. But then there's a free function. There's a free function that I have to fix. What fixes that? It's a differential equation. A boundary condition fixes that. I have to specify at some initial time where did I displace it? Where did I start at t is equal to zero, how far did I displace it? And then that gives me the complete information about the solution of how this thing is moving. Well, it turns out that if I give one more dimension to this, not time, but some internal spatial dimension, this is equivalent to an equation of a string. Okay? So not just having an implicit time dependence, but also an implicit spatial dependence is what a string is. Okay?
So there is time, and then it has some signal, which is like some intrinsic spatial thing. And that maps into, in a sense, a point in space. Now, what's interesting is that you have to specify boundary conditions here too, but not just in time, but also at the endpoints. Okay, and you can have those endpoints can have free boundary conditions or fixed boundary conditions. The same way at time, right? You can leave it free by just saying I don't choose to specify at what time the thing begins and what time it ends. You can choose to do that with the length of the string, and that defines this situation.
or this situation. One is called a Neumann boundary condition, okay, which you'll learn, and the other one is called a Dirichlet boundary condition. And that's where D-brain comes from Dirichlet boundary condition. I don't know if that was on. I just had a string theory. What's going on?
Any other? Yeah.
Would you say in general then that like your creativity drives your math behind it, or the other way around?
Yeah, that's a really good question too. I think so. Right before I went off to postdoc, I was really scared because I didn't see myself as a person that was a quick calculator, right? And you know, I had one professor, he's a Russian guy. You get off on your feet, you start running. And, you know, it's really scary. So there was this guy, Jim Gates. He was a professor, a string theorist, and we were like, he was very nice to me, so I felt I was able to talk. So I'm really concerned. Close the door. I said, can we lock the door? Can I have to ask you something? It's like, you know, could you, so I'm scared that I won't survive. You know, those people are quick and not. He goes, let me tell you something, son. But this guy has, you probably see pictures, you want to grab Jim Gates. He has a huge afro. He's really, really, really smart person. He co-invented something called supersymmetry. So kind of crazy, but anyway, he's a guy.
And was he in the Alien universe?
Einstein's an odd man out. So Jim, so I said, he said, look, let me tell you a story. So you know, you have to have the idea before you do the calculation. I said, what? Are you kidding me? You mean to say that? Because I had this impression that you're going to have these guys that are locked in a room for like 14 hours just calculating, you know, this kind of stuff. And then they get the answer, right? I said, no, you have to know the answer before you do the calculation, because it makes sense. You can go down the wrong path and like have it all wrong, and you wasted 6 months. He said, so make sure, like, you know, make sure you have an idea of what the answer is going to be before you do it. And I think this is very important. I don't think. So the lesson there was, yeah, make sure that you have the skill set that you actually know how to do a calculation, right? That you're able to do that. Make sure you have that. But the way the human mind works, we don't understand how the human mind works. We have something called an intuition, and it's very powerful. And it is much more powerful than, you know, I mean, we're able to come up with math. Forget about doing math. You know, it may turn out that like, you have an idea and you might have to create the math to do it. So the intuition is much more powerful and, of course, enabled by, you know, one's ability to do technical things here. Okay? So I don't know if that answers.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not a little formal and everything.
So was it, when you went to the cafeteria and to talk in order to talk to that guy, was that hearing you went to university? Because I didn't get that.
No, I was a postdoctoral person. The guy in the cafeteria. Because I talked to bums in cafes when I was in college, but they were no help.
Any more questions? About the inflation. The inflation was the sudden expansion of the whole universe. So how fast was it?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's a really good question. Okay. So inflation is an expansion of space. But the other thing to understand is that light, which defines speed, which also will expand with space. So there really isn't a proper definition for, I mean, in other words, to define how fast something is moving, something needs to be, you know, at rest relative to that thing moving. We learned that from special relativity. But if it's a whole universe that's expanding, you need, you know, you need to be in some other part of the universe, you know, outside the universe, to measure its expansion rate. Okay.
So you cannot define.
So it's not a well-defined. It's a good question to ask. It's a good question to ask. It's a good question to ask. But what I can say is that we have something called diffeomorphism of variance, which is general. Einstein taught us that how you specify, how you label a coordinate system, right? Which means that you're specifying things like, you know, you're here, I'm here, and I'm measuring a velocity of something. Is actually redundant. It carries no physical information. So to say, well, how fast the universe expanded is a good question, but it's also, so people use the word, the universe expands superluminally. Okay, so one way to answer the question is to say that scales, okay, so what I mean by an inch today was different from an inch in the past because the universe was a much smaller place, all right? But it turns out that there's a way in which an inch is an inch.
So you mean that because of the big gravitation which was in that time, the distances were...
Yeah, it comes out to the point that, that's right, so it comes out to the point that to define speed, you need to have space by which something is moving.
Yeah.
But if gravity is expanded at some rate, and Einstein tells us, well, that's just equivalent to space expanding. So you run into this conceptual, it's a conceptual issue. I know I'm not giving you a good answer. Because it's, but it's one of these things where it's all like, it's very similar to the question saying, what is the universe expanded into if it is expanded? Right? It's just expanded in itself. Okay?
Your question actually.
Yep. Yeah. Based on the importance you put on intuition, right? Do you then think that in order to make any significant contributions to quantum mechanics, one requires to get a certain intuitive view of quantum mechanics?
I think if you really have an intuitive view of quantum mechanics, you become a mad person. but no, so to answer your question, yes, of course. I think the degree to which we could actually intuitively understand quantum mechanics is the degree to which we could understand where it might need to be modified. So some people here at the Kerman Institute that work on the foundations of quantum mechanics, and I'm sure that some of them will be coming to talk with you, they could say a lot more, believe that fundamentally there's something wrong or something that needs to be changed about quantum mechanics. Whatever that is going to be absolutely crazy. And I'm sure whatever it is, many people are not going to get it. It's going to be like when Einstein came in. Not many people are going to get it. Okay? Maybe one of you one day might be that person.
It's funny if I could ask you a question, because I remember when I was 16 years old, when I was grade 11, I had a lot of people in my physics class that were really smart, got great marks in physics, but they didn't want to do physics as the only thing they could picture themselves. They wanted to study physics at university and be a physicist or a physics teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't really sure about that. Mm-hmm. Just wondering if you have any friends that you studied with physics with and that's gone into the, I don't know, work as traders on Wall Street or medical physicists. Or
yeah.
If you have any general comments about the value of studying physics and where it can lead you other than being a...
Yeah, no, that's a great important question. I have had a very interesting situation. I had a number of friends that studied the physical sciences, you know, physics or physical, you know, physical sciences. I just put it into one thing. Of course, I think physics is like, you know, my the best thing you can study well done graduate. I really think that it provides you with a solid grounding, but, you know, such that whatever you bifurcate out into, it's a very beneficial thing. I had a friend that is now a rap producer. He is actually one of, like, you know, he is a very creative rap producer, and he's doing really well for himself. He's produced a number of people that you've probably heard already. And you can hear the difference in this music he's making from everybody else. It's coming from out of the box. It's totally creative. And if you sit down and you talk to him, he realizes that the source of it, he's applying things like quantum mechanics into making his beats. he has a totally different approach that only a physics person would ever come up with. And as a result, his career has taken off as a musician. And he still talks to me about it. We're able to talk about physics. He has a bunch of crazy ideas, but we won't get into that. He seems to have this belief that he can manipulate people's, like, quantum wave function with his beats. I was like, look, that thing is just proportional to age bars. No way, it's 2 naps far. It's not going to happen. Like, oh, it's going to be some resonance, man. The whole globe's going to get it. I have a friend is now a brain surgeon. He actually goes into people's brains. A former physicist going into people's brains, that is not a good thing. But he majored in physics in college and went to medical school and now is he is, from what I heard, a pretty good brain surgeon. You know what happened to those people that said that? He's doing really well for himself. I have another friend that works for a company called Citigroup, and it's a Citigroup is the largest investment bank in the world, whatever. And what he does, he was actually a physics professor, actually. He became a physics professor and then decided, you know, I want to be a millionaire. I mean, he was, for him, it was like, he became poor, that he's like, I want to be a millionaire, but I still want to do math. So then he started doing all this quantitative stuff. But apparently, some of these companies now are starting to create positions that are sort of like research positions. They're not really like, oh, just go and crunch numbers to me. He showed me one of his notebooks. He said, this is what I worked on today. And I was just, there are no numbers here. Like, you're doing like cohomology, you're doing math that I do. He's like, yeah, I just apply, like, you know, these fools, like, they believe anything I tell them. I was like talking about fiber bundles, and we're principal fiber bundles, and all this crazy, really cool math that I'm into, right? He's like, yeah, just use this big word and write down these symbols, and they pay me money for it. They make this $500 million decision because I told them that, you know, we need to solve this equation first. No numbers, like, this is great. So there's a, you know, you sound like physics, and you keep an open mind. You find all of a sudden that you are in great demand, okay? Because you need to learn how to think, you know. But my caveat in all of that is learning how to think is also about, you know, truly, truly being open-minded. And I think open-minded toward people. So that's a caveat. If you do something like physics, it does have, like, the physics culture does have at least in America, at least, you know, there is a sort of like competitive thing, da 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 da, or like you only do physics because you want to be a physicist, and if you act or talk or look a certain way, then you're really not like a physicist, and that's the caveat. The caveat is like, don't pay any attention to your ideas. Do physics if you're going to do it. If you want to become a physicist, that's great. If you don't want to become a physicist, it's great too, because now you've learned some cool stuff. And you can go out into the world and make millions of dollars, or save the world and save people, or whatever, you know. Work on people's brains. Still don't get that.
Question. Repeat.
Yes, sir.
I didn't have a trick question. You mentioned that you might become a professional musician. I was just wondering what instrument you play.
Well, pretty soon I'm going to be playing down in the music room with my. It's my office name is also Jazz Pianist, right? So we're going to be jamming downstairs at some point. So I play sax, saxophone.
Tenor and alto.
I play both. My main thing is the tenor. Do you play?
I play bass.
Okay. So I notice that I'm not getting any question from the other half of our population here. Yes?
Just for curiosity, because I might want to ask you something again, but not right now. So are you sticking around and turning your instrument?
Yeah, I'm free. As long as you guys are from room 256, more or less free to talk to about, anything except beer and wine. Well, let's get some more questions from, yes, please.
You said that, before you went and wrote the commitment paper, you had doubts about, your career choice or critical criticism. Do you find that now that you have had a certain success, do you still doubt yourself occasionally? Or do you find now it's, it was definitely, what I love and, all this stuff?
No, I still doubt myself. I'm filled with doubt. I think, but I think the difference is that I see it actually as a, it's not like I try to impose doubt on my life, right? It's an ideal state maybe to strive to is to be completely doubtless about anything. But I think my attitude is, it's to embrace it. It's okay, it's actually the human condition, and I feel at place in the world. I feel very much connected to everybody now because I have this doubt. I have doubts about myself. And it gives me a sense of perspective that I'm fortunate in some ways because I have maybe less doubt than some people, right? So I don't know, I feel a lot more, I feel that's okay. Before, the problem was I had doubt and I felt I felt depressed about it and it just, in some ways, you want to quit and these kind of things. Now the notion of quitting and all these things, I can embrace the doubt and say, this is part of it and actually, it's part of getting to the next step and success. It's kind of part of the driving force.
So you didn't eradicate, you just kind of learn how to deal with it and embrace it?
Yeah, just learn how to embrace it more. Yeah. Yes, please.
What school are you working at again as a professor?
I am Kent State University.
What are you working on now as a researcher?
I'm working on, to me, one of the most beautiful, it's not beautiful. There's something called the hierarchy problem. And it's a question of why is it that gravity is weaker than the other three forces? But somehow there's this very interesting coincidence. It's this crazy coincidence, and it bugs me out. And it has to do with something called dark energy. Okay? And I can imagine, maybe you can think about it. If anyone has anything to tell me about this, it would be great. So here's a numerical coincidence.
Whoa.
Okay, here's the numerical coincidence. We have observation enough, for example, we can look at these exploding stars called supernova, and they're really far away from us. And by studying how fast they move away from us, it tells us basically how much the universe is accelerating. And then it turns out, from a very similar equation to F is equal to ma, which is the acceleration of the universe, this thing is proportional to the amount of dark energy, which is what I call lambda. It's a cosmological constant. So there's an equation that actually relates the amount of dark energy to the acceleration of the universe. This equation comes from Einstein's theory of general relativity. So the point is, of this thing, this number is fixed experimentally, all right? And it turns out that if you sum all the total amount of matter and stuff in the universe, okay, so we're made up of baryonic matter, nucleons and protons and all that good stuff, that's only 0.5%, okay, of this stuff. It turns out that roughly 70% according to the observations, is made up of this dark energy. Okay? This is what, this observation has been made by two independent means. Okay? And it comes up with the same number, so there's a big mystery. But here's what's interesting. If you measure, there's another measurement that we can measure, which is the mass on something called the W and the Z boson. Okay? These are particles, they're like light particles that mediate something called the electroweak force. Alright, so it's a subatomic force. Okay? So you're talking about strong force, electroweak force. Well, the electroweak force is a force that really generates the mass, okay, of our nuclei. And that mass, okay, I will write this thing as M for electroweak. Okay? The cosmological concept has the dimension of mass. So usually you put a bracket to denote the dimension of something. And electroweak has dimensions of mass, of course. If you measure the masses of the W boson and the Z boson, which you can do, okay, and you measure the value of the cosmological constant, if you square this and you divide this by, so these two numbers that you measure, you get the Planck scale, which is the scale of quantum gravity. This is, these two numbers are measure quantities and it gives you this. However, these two things, these three things, are absolute mysteries in physics. We have right now no viable theory that explains the origin of the what we call the electroweak symmetry breaking scale. How these masses arise. We have no viable theory of understanding the origin of dark matter, and we don't know what quantum gravity is. And somehow these numbers are just coincident, it's called a triple coincidence. You measure these quantities and it's this. Okay, so what I'm working on is a way of explaining these things by an absolutely mad, insane idea. It has nothing to do with flattened brains. But anyway, the thing that, this is the stuff that I'm reading, like, wow, what is nature trying to tell us about this triple coincidence? And somehow what it's telling us is that quantum gravity, okay, so gravity and the electroweak force, first of all, here's a really cool thing. Of all the four forces in nature, only one force, okay, has a hand in this. I mean, it violates parity. It has a what we call chirality, okay? And it's the electroweak force. So the strong force, the electromagnetic force, and as you know, I thought today, gravity, all are mirror reflection. All the interactions that happen respect an inversion in the mirror, except the electroweak force. And that is what gives matter the property that it has is because of the electroweak force. The fact that we have chirality transmits itself into our biomolecules. All of these sugars and RNA material, so basically living things, for example, are all chiral. Okay? They have this hand in this. DNA is chiral. So people have speculated that this is coming because of the electroweak force that's transmitting this to larger and larger scales. Right? So somehow there's some deep connection between the chiral nature, of space-time. Okay? There's a hand in this in space-time and this thing and the cosmological concept. Anyway, I can go on talking days and days and days about this because but my point is that there's so many cool things, not so many cool things. And let's say one last thing. I think, though, that quantum mechanics, one cool thing that is a big part of our future in science, is a connection between the brain and something like foundations of quantum mechanics. I just want to leave that in your head because I think the field of like cognitive science and like, you know, how those two things work together is a very exciting thing. That if I were in your shoes and I were thinking about, like, you know, I would like, okay, I'm going to major in physics, and then I'm going to go do, like, you know, cognitive science and that kind of stuff. I really think that, you know, that connection might help resolve a lot of foundational issues that we have in quantum mechanics. So.
Okay, so we can stand up. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Feel free to talk to Stefan, although maybe not all at once.
I'm in 256.
Okay, it is break time now. So we will have a little break. We come back in about 20 minutes.